वेलकम टू दिस एपिसोड ऑफ द वर्ल्ड अकॉर्डिंग टू आइरिना शुकरमैन, आवर वेरी ओन स्पेशल सीरीज ऑन ग्लोबल पॉलिटिक्स ऑन द केएजे मास्टर क्लास लाइव. आइरिना शुकरमैन इज अ यूएस बेस्ड नेशनल सिक्योरिटी एंड ह्यूमन राइट्स लॉयर एज वेल एज अ रेनाउंड जियोपॉलिटिकल एनालिस्ट. हर राइटिंग्स एंड कमेंट्री हैव अपीयर्ड इन डाइवर्स यूएस एंड इंटरनेशनल मीडिया एंड हैव बीन ट्रांसलेटेड टू ओवर अ डजन लैंग्वेजेस. एवरी फोर्टनाइट इन द वर्ल्ड अकॉर्डिंग टू आइरिना शुकरमैन, we traverse the geopolitical landscape and delve into pressing international issues and gain insight from Irina's expert perspective. Welcome to the show once again, Irina.
Thank you. Glad to be here as usual.
Thank you. Welcome to the show. Welcome. Now, Irina, several big topics again today, and one big topic is about the Israel-Hamas issue. So what's happening there? The whole talks and all these things does not seem to be working, and Israel seems to be moving into Rafah. So help us understand what's the latest on there and how should we look at it. Peace seems to be a bit distant now.
So a couple of things happened. First of all, the final version of the ceasefire was rejected by Hamas, and Hamas demanded a unilateral withdrawal, which Israel rejected in turn. And once they start, and Hamas at that point caused a provocation by attacking from Rafah and killing four Israeli soldiers and wounding several others. At that point, Israel moved into Rafah, and Hamas claimed that they wanted to accept the ceasefire once Israel started preparing for Rafah incursion. But there was a significant difference between the original proposal approved and reviewed by the United States, Egypt, and Qatar, and what Hamas claimed they were willing to accept. Entering Rafah, Israel discovered many more tunnels, which were used to smuggle weapons and fighters, and some of these tunnels also led into Egypt, and they've been built over decades. Israel engaged in it evacuated 450,000 people into a humanitarian camp nearby in another part of Gaza, and killed hundreds of terrorists within just a few days while expanding its operations. U.S. has tried to pressure Israel to withdraw from Rafah completely. Plus, there is also a growing tension with Egypt. Egypt is concerned about a potential flood of refugees over the border. Israel at one point threatened to transfer the control of the border crossing to the Palestinian Authority, which would be extremely ineffective. Israeli foreign minister also claimed that Egypt should be the one accepting refugees internally. And meanwhile, the U.S. said that they're freezing not only ammunition, one shipment of ammunition that they already previously froze, but all precision weapons that Israel had already paid for would not be delivered, which caused a major political upheaval both in the U.S. and internationally. So that's basically the lay of the land and where we are now. The operations in Rafah are expanding. At the same time, there is a concern that as Israel is relocating its troops to Rafah, other parts of Gaza are being repopulated by Hamas fighters who are basically rebuilding due to the lack of counterinsurgency framework.
Right, Irina. Even in the north of Gaza Strip, Israeli troops are back fighting in the north of Gaza Strip in areas that they were supposed to have cleared months ago. But, so it shows that finishing off Hamas, as earlier their mission was, seems to be a bit distant in the future. How does that look? And why I'm asking is to understand where this whole war is going on. Looks like this will continue to be, both sides seem to be strong enough to continue this fight for a long, long time. And this humanitarian crisis will also continue along with that? How do you look at it?
Well, there's a couple of things going on. First of all, both sides of the war are being funded sometimes by the same people, including by the United States. While U.S. has not directly given weapons to Hamas, of course, they have provided Iran, which is, you know, backs Hamas with significant weapons. Iran, in turn, has been flooding West Bank with weapons, and there is a possibility that some of it is making its way into Gaza as well. Of course, a lot of the humanitarian aid was also misappropriated by Hamas, sold off, and used to support their activities, not to mention the billions that they've accumulated over the years. They seem to be able to recruit more fighters from the general population. Also, the numbers of Hamas operatives were not all that accurate. They were understated from the very beginning because it's very difficult to make these estimates. Now, Hamas does not necessarily announce full lists of their official membership. So in terms of military power, you know, we are seeing that because we are fighting a terrorist organization, it's not going to be as straightforward as confronting a state actor. There is also another issue brought up by American analysts, which is that Israel has in the past years has moved, followed an American military doctrine, which was mostly counterterrorism focused. They moved away from pledging significant conventional forces, focused on small, short blitzkrieg type battles. And basically the idea that became popular in the West is that the era of big, long, drawn-out combat is over. That's obviously turned out not to be the case. Instead, we're seeing hybrid, high-tech, low-tech combinations, combining elements of traditional warfare and insurgency. So Israel is going to have to adapt to it. In the meantime, it's spending tremendous amounts of money. The fending off of the missiles from Iran cost approximately $1 billion just from Israel. That's just military costs alone, not counting the economic costs of the closed up airspace and anything else. Literally, just the cost of the missiles. So we are seeing that it's also a very expensive confrontation, but Hamas is able to fundraise effectively. They're also able to present themselves effectively. They've changed the narrative for presenting themselves as a terrorist organization aimed at destroying Israel, which they are and have never changed, to being a resistance against Israeli occupation and so forth, which is how they're being increasingly presented. One example is the BBC, where David Cameron confronted the BBC and asked why this taxpayer-backed organization not following the official UK policy to consider Hamas a terrorist organization, and they rejected it, and basically they consider Hamas a potentially legitimate resistance fighting force. So we are seeing that seep back into the media. We're seeing certainly that narrative being adapted on campuses, both by the students, the faculty, but also outside organizers. And it's been very actively promoted and creates this broader fight outside the direct field, which is a source of strength to Hamas, and which helps also with their recruitment effort as well.
Right, Irina. So what are the options for the U.S. here? Because it seems to be running out of options in either the Israel-Hamas crisis, even in Ukraine, even in Niger. We'll come to that a bit later. But is it a problem with the Biden administration, or is it that actually they are not having much options? No one can have many options in this situation. So starting with Israel, means what are the options here for U.S.? Initially, it looked like to be trying to do so many things.
Well, it seems that the U.S. does not seem to have a clear objective of what it wants accomplished. In the beginning, Biden stated that they want Hamas gone from power. Now they claim that Israel may not be able to achieve that end. They were pushing for the Palestinian Authority to rule over Gaza. That is obviously not possible for many reasons. And I think they are not capable to admit that there may be a prolonged conflict. They want a quick, clear solution, which is simply not, even if that solution is returning to the pre-October 7th status quo with Hamas in power, but that is no longer the option, not only because Israel will not accept it, which it won't, but also because Iran no longer feels that it needs to contain its proxies in any way, because it feels it has achieved significant victory, not only on the battlefield, but in terms in creating these narratives that are now pushing for a state, for the many states are about to recognize Palestine as an independent entity. Obviously, logistically speaking, it's not possible, but it plays into Iran's narrative very well. So why would it want a return to any lesser field when it has already made significant breakthroughs all around? But behind all of this, there are two major factors. One is the ideologically, the Biden administration is following the Obama foreign policy line, which sought to strengthen Iran's presence in the region. For whatever reason, they thought it was a good idea. The official narrative was it was to balance between Sunni and Shia. Obviously, it's all a grossly oversimplified narrative that no real specialist would ever consider seriously. The powers are not equal. First of all, Iran is not all Shia. Just like even Saudi Arabia is not all Sunni. Second, Saudi Arabia is not, and it's in other Sunni states, we're not necessarily seeking expansion across the region. They were not arming factions to attack random international forces, which Iran very much has. And second of all, Iran's version of Shia Islam is very far from its original version. It has adopted political elements from various other doctrines. So we are looking at a hybrid, complex political ideology that has nothing to do with the old religious and political dispute within Islamic factions. We are talking about a political, geopolitical vision that's entirely at odds with the rest of the humanity. Those are just some of the reasons why that discourse was ridiculous, but we are seeing, practically speaking, Iran aligning with whoever is willing to play along for power for other reasons. Qatar is Sunni, but Qatar is one of the closest allies that Iran has in the region. It has worked with the Muslim Brotherhood factions across the Middle East and elsewhere quite closely. Strictly speaking, Muslim Brotherhood came from Sunni-affiliated ideological groups who then took on other elements from other political and religious traditions, but also their own interpretations of the religion. So we are seeing an alliance of revolutionary political Islamist factions, which is not something that Obama was ever willing to fully admit was going to be either, would happen, or when it did, that it was something that is an extreme threat to the regional stability. So that's one factor. The other factor is simply we have a lack of leadership and a lack of professionalism among the foreign policy establishment in the Biden administration. We're having people who have come from very highly ideological backgrounds with no professional exposure to the areas that they're being challenged and faced with at the moment. Most of them came out from academic or think tank worlds or Europe-oriented diplomatic traditions. They simply have not been exposed to reality, and they adamantly listen to only the types of sources, limited types of sources from regional and other voices, whether it's Israel, other parts of the Middle East, Ukraine, Africa, or anywhere else, it's the same story, which is why we're seeing a pattern of appeasement. This idea that diplomacy can solve all problems. The school of thought forgets that diplomacy is just one tool in the political arsenal and it's aimed to complement other tools rather than be an end in itself. So we are seeing very strange situations where the administration is funding all sides in various conflicts, where it's slow rolling assistance to Ukraine, where it's refusing to impose certain types of sanctions on Russia, which would be highly detrimental to its economy, where it's banning Ukraine from targeting oil refineries and prolonging the conflict after, the weapons that are now being delivered after 6 months give breathing room for Russians to make significant advances internally. Similarly, the administration continues viewing Iran as somehow a sacrosanct entity immune from a very serious direct pushback, which is why it banned even Israel from responding more assertively to unprecedented direct attacks recently, which is why, despite the economic disaster that has befallen the Red Sea, the administration has refused to attack Iranian entities. So this is quite odd, because initially the argument was that there was a concern about an escalation, a direct war. First of all, that escalation has continued regardless of what anyone else does by Iran and its proxies. And second, Iranian military is not that strong. And, supposedly it has not yet developed a nuclear weapon. So this would be a good time to significantly curtail its military capabilities if you want to put an end to its ambitions in the region, to its ability to continue to wreak havoc, fund terrorist organizations, and so forth. But curiously, despite these logical observations, the administration is just not keen in confronting Iran in any way and continues to shield it from any sort of real accountability, and so the conflicts proliferate.
Right. So when now coming back to the Niger part, which we earlier mentioned, here again one more issue for the U.S. administration. Forget about the troops pullout. Right now, U.S. and Russian troops are in that same area. So is it a tough balancing act for them, or is it a chance to create some friendly atmosphere between U.S. and Russia? How do you look at that? Because one little incident and it can create a big problem.
It is, but I think the Russian troops see it as a huge victory, politically speaking, whereas for the U.S. it's unquestionably a defeat and an easily avoidable one at that. So the official explanation from Niger about all of this was that, well, U.S. was lecturing about democracy, it was making threats, political threats, and so on and so forth, and so we will not cooperate with them on counterterrorism, we will rely on Russians instead. Now, let's face it, the Russians have proven terribly ineffective, and it wasn't even their real ambition to fight with the terrorists. Their ambition is to prop up regimes, gain access to resources, grab and run, and basically, but also get U.S. and France kicked out if possible, which they succeeded at. Now, for the U.S., the official policy was to prioritize democracy and legitimacy of the governments, but U.S. has failed at that as well due to lack of consistency. Once these regimes have started falling, have started taking over democratically elected government, U.S. has not pushed for a very strong international response. It has not empowered ECOWAS to take any action, and it certainly did not take any action to get its ally, the president, the legitimately elected president of Nigeria, released from his confinement, where he's been reportedly subjected to extreme conditions. So this sends a signal that U.S. is not reliable in supporting its allies, that its concerns about democracy are entirely symbolic, that it barks loudly, but barks louder than, you know, strong. Its bark is bigger than its bite. And so it gives an excuse to all these regimes to simply get annoyed, and, you know, it's neither here nor there. You know, if the U.S. is willing to tolerate these regimes, then it should probably stay away from discussions of democracy and focus on counterterrorism, on prioritize that. If, on the other hand, it believes that these regimes are a central threat, then it should be taking action to show that it stands up for what it believes in.
Absolutely, absolutely. The questions about how much U.S. stands with the allies, and forget about standing with the allies. You go and call them xenophobic, like Biden called India and Japan and put them in the bracket of Russia and China. Why is it intentional? Is it to gain any particular? Did he gain anything out of this? What will be the impact of this? Obviously, no one will like it. So, what's the politics behind this all, Irina?
For whatever reason, the Biden administration continues to believe that it can play to domestic audiences at the expense of its partners, and that these partners, out of necessity, will just ignore these issues and move on. The problem is, it creates a very popular animus that even if the governments are willing to overlook these sort of statements, as long as they're not followed by any sorts of actions, which they haven't been, to be fair, you know, it still sends a message to the enemies, and it just creates unnecessary tensions. And I do believe that in practice, Biden has been relatively consistent in actually forging stronger military and economic relations with both India and Japan. And one example of that was a presence of a number of of tech billionaires and assorted personalities at the major social function, the wedding of the owner of the Reliance conglomerate in India. The fact that all these Americans showed up is a sign that there is clearly a very positive practical dynamic, and from what I understand, a number of agreements were recently signed, shifting some of the U.S. corporate activity from Singapore to India, which is good for India economically, and clearly clearly the statement about xenophobia has not had any impact on these relations on the ground. But where it may have impact is that it does empower political campaigns, it does empower opposition movements, certainly, which is, you know, a sort of an election meddling, because India right now is in the middle of elections. It's not a good time for making such statements. Not that there's ever a great time, but this is particularly ill-timed. No doubt that such a statement will actually help Prime Minister Modi's party. But nevertheless, it's not, it's not the sort of statement that should be made in the middle of elections. And it will empower also other anti-India voices, both in the U.S. and internationally, the sort of campaigns that are seeking to undermine the current gains India is making. It certainly helps China and Russia to see that Japan and India, respectively, are being put in the same category with them. This sort of moral relativism is exactly the sort of narrative that they love to exploit. So it will ultimately backfire the United States more than anything else.
Right, Irina, right. So let's move on to China now. China in Yemen, recruiting heavily. What does it mean? Is it, help us understand its vision here, strategic vision here.
Well, China considers Yemen a strategically important country because of its location. The Strait of Hormuz is in fact very important for trade, but it's also been expanding its influence and outreach all over the Arab world. And it seeks to make gains where the US is obviously losing. And it seeks to co-opt movements that see themselves as being largely abandoned, including the legitimate government of Yemen, including various tribes and in tribal frameworks, and including, of course, the Southern Transitional Council, which is a separatist. And this is exactly the sort of thing that China wants to expand. So we are seeing them focusing not only on their very positive dynamic with the Houthis, who have control over most of the population in Yemen, but they're also forging ties with southern Yemenis who used to come from a communist tradition, let's remember, originally. And it was the West used to back the more Islamist and more religious factions who were in the beginning not what they are now. They were not radicalized. But the South was traditionally aligned with communists. Then it has shifted gears more recently towards a more capitalist model. But overall, it's a deeply tribal society with old ties that China is reawakening by bringing people into its universities, training them militarily, trying to forge trade ties. And the South right now is facing a very tough economic situation due to many things: corruption, ongoing impact of the internal struggles, resurgence of Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda's partnership with Houthis, and of course, the general abandonment of them by the other Arab states in the region who are trying to make peace deals with the Houthis. So this is an ideal environment for China to try to make a footprint. I'm not sure that China is equipped for dealing with the sort of sectarianism that Yemen is facing, but they are looking to gain practical advantages where they can, even if it's something very limited and specific, and certainly to potentially utilize these movements and groups against the West if possible, and to gain control and favorable and privileged access to the waterways, which are normally filled with the Western navies, to be fair. But this dynamic could change if the southern population becomes hostile to the West.
Right, Irina. Very ideal environment for China in Yemen, but not very good environment for China about TikTok in the US. So what happens to that bill? Where do we see it at present? Do you think TikTok will have no other option and that either it diverts or it gets banned? How do you see it? What is the latest on that?
Well, the bill has been signed into law by President Biden, which means that indeed they have 6 months to make up their mind. But ByteDance, the parent company, already said that the algorithm is so valuable that they would rather see TikTok banned completely than give it up, which raises a lot of questions, quite frankly, and only substantiates the national security concerns of the members of Congress that voted for this bill despite a very aggressive lobbying campaign. So now ByteDance is bringing in TikTok, they're bringing lawsuits against the US government claiming that they're infringing on their freedom, on their First Amendment rights. But the truth of the matter is foreign entities are not entitled to the same constitutional protections as US-based entities and individuals. So I really don't think this sort of argument will stand a chance. And quite frankly, I can't imagine why it would work at all. If TikTok is indeed banned at the end of the day, and China will still have succeeded in gathering hundreds of millions of data points from all over the United States, and most of them are not going to radically change. Biometric data is not going to change, even if TikTok is now banned. They will lose a valuable source of propaganda and disseminated content and data gathering, but I am sure they have other means of collecting that information in addition to TikTok, so I wouldn't be too worried about them.
Absolutely. And talking of propaganda, Israel seem to be losing on a lot on this whole, publicity. in fact, getting a lot of negative publicity, not only in the world, especially in the U.S. campuses. A lot of young students thinking and coming out in pro-Palestinian support. And then also, there is a lot of talk about Israeli forces, several units who have not been conducting themselves well as per several reports. So how do you see this part? A lot of, you can say, negative reporting about Israel, and it's not making, and that even the Al Jazeera thing, all these things add up to, is it just by itself or is there a concerted effort behind all these incidents that are happening?
So here's the thing. Israel finally banned Al Jazeera. Their offices were raided and shut down. But that's not really going to make much of a difference. Just because Al Jazeera is no longer located in Israel doesn't mean that it will not have a direct feed from Gaza from string reporters and local operatives. All it does is, limit the indoctrination of the Israelis who are, for whatever reason, listening to that stuff. Now, ironically, Al Jazeera is the outlet that American students are turning to because they are frustrated with the U.S. media's coverage of the conflict. Despite consistent criticism from mainstream media, they still think this is not sufficiently anti-Israel enough. So they're looking for confirmation bias, not information, and Al Jazeera will certainly provide that. But it's not just the students that are part of the problem. Actually, the students are the minority. These active students are a minority, even on campuses, even though they've been making a lot of noise. Recent polls showed that most students are literally not interested in that issue at all and don't prioritize it. So we are looking at very limited numbers of students who are being galvanized, and most other students are really not at all concerned about this issue. But the problem is we have other people joining in, and the problem is they are creating less numbers, and the real problem is not even even the professors who are demonstrating and outside activists who are training them, and the fact that there's been weapons found and clearly revolutionary activity going on, but the fact that the funding for all of this is coming from both likely foreign sources, including, by the way, some people with ties to China, not just Qatar, as one might imagine, and Iran and so forth, but also from huge domestic donors, mainstream donors with ties to Obama and Biden administrations, huge left-leaning corporations that are funding these protests very directly and creating these revolutionary movements that will become an even bigger problem down the road. There's now an effort to crack down on the actual manifestations, but that won't stop the ideological movement that's there. It will at best take it outside university campuses and to the streets. So we have a big problem of these corporations meddling into the political process by funding these organizations, and they're mainstream democratic donors. They're not just fringe groups, neo-Nazis or, communists or people or even pro-Hamas organizations. They've made an alliance, a network. And what we're seeing is a centralized, decentralized approach that has become very common, starting with the Arab Spring and moving into Occupy Wall Street and all these other movements in the United States, which means that there is a central group of interest that is coordinating on some level, but on a lower level, essentially, you have different people pursuing different agendas jointly. But you do have a core group that ideologically is in alignment. And the point of alignment is the hatred for Israel and for the United States as well. So some of these same entities are also the ones behind disinformation campaigns about these Israeli units. One of them is an Qatar-backed US-based organization registered to an Al Jazeera reporter called Dawn Mina, Democracy in the for the Arab World Now, Democracy in the Middle East and North Africa, rather. And this organization was originally envisioned by Jamal Khashoggi. I think you can, just that name alone and his association will tell you everything you need to know about their ideological structure, funding, and makeup. But they forged strong ties with certain members of the administration, many of whom have a significant State Department, National Security Council, Department of Commerce, and other, and even intelligence positions. They have the same ideology. These particular people have the same ideological vision. And what these groups have been doing is forging essentially reports giving names of alleged violators, and the administration has been basically buying into these reports without fact checking them. And there's really no independent way to fact check them, because we're talking about events that predate October 7th, and nobody was really following what was going on at the time. So you have one-sided reports that are impossible to refute, really, that are being proposed by organizations that have already established themselves as having formal relationships and trusted sources with the administration. We are facing a very, very effective BDS campaign. In fact, thankfully, the sanctions ultimately did not materialize, but critical reports did, and still this level of propaganda feeds into this anti-Israel narrative and also presents Israel as the bad guy, or at least not a altogether good guy, to the general population, who are saying, well, if the US government is saying they've committed all these crimes, then why should we be as supportive of them as we have been previously? Maybe they don't have as much legitimacy. Maybe those Hamas people have a point. Let's see. So this is the impact that it's having. It's long-term. It's not always clearly visible, but it's highly destructive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a very confusing issue. Thank you very much for helping us understand in depth, Irina. And it looks like that Israel has a big job in hand in terms of employing some good publicity campaign, good PR campaign, speaking about their part of their all those things. Be that as it may, let's move on to Ukraine. And there UK has allowed, as they said, that it will allow Ukraine to use its weapon for offensive use. So this has created a lot of, sound and noise from even Russia with its saying about nuclear, all those drills. And also help us understand, does Ukraine actually mean this? Is it a good move, not good move? How do you think Russia will take it if it actually starts working on the ground?
Well, we can see that no matter what Ukraine has done, Russia has not used nuclear weapons, and it won't. Actually, the most recent development is that they had a major government reshuffle. So at the end of the day, what that tells us is that A, they're preparing for a very long-term war, and B, Putin is sending a message to all parties involved, whether on his own side or abroad, that he is the only one in charge, and all these officials that he appointed, some of them completely seemingly unqualified for their positions, it doesn't matter because it's his choice. He puts whoever he feels in charge, he removes them at will, and the main point is that his own commitment to this war. And he's in it for the long run, which means no nuclear weapons. Because, nuclear wars tend to escalate dramatically and usually end things very quickly. There was only one instance of that happening for a good reason. So that itself, all the signaling just reinforces the idea that despite loud rhetoric, Russia has no intention of using nuclear weapons. However, the very fact that nuclear weapons are coming into a picture despite any lack of intention on Russia's part contributes to a sense of insecurity, because anything can happen, accidents can happen. Now, even in the course of maintaining these nuclear weapons, shifting them to Belarus, these are environmentally unfriendly concentrations of nuclear power. And Russia is not known to be a responsible actor. This means also there's a lot of corruption, which means terrorist groups could get their hands on components or even nuclear weapons potentially. We should hope not, but this is a possible outcome of all this talk among such actors as Russia and Belarus. So, while I don't think we should expect a nuclear war anytime soon, we should be concerned about what may happen with these weapons even being used symbolically.
Absolutely, absolutely. You have explained a lot of issues in a very nice manner to a lot of things. And the world continues to look like that these issues will continue to come up much more strongly in the days to come. And with your help, we will continue to understand it better. With this, it's a wrap on this very special edition of The World According to Irina Shukerman this week on the KJ Masterclass Live. As I said, we'll continue to keep on getting more such analysis from you every 2 weeks. With this, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you so much.